Okay. So as usual, the way I run this is same as always, bones first, then joints, and then muscles after that. So it's not going to be any different than usual. I'll bet you nobody brought their skeleton today, did they? Sorry, I'm missing my clavicle. I just had it last night. That's unusual. Sorry, guys. My clavicle was here last night. I don't know where it is. There it is. Okay. Bones related to the shoulder. So when we think of girdles, it has more to do with the association to the axial skeleton. So we say the shoulder, which represents the shoulder joint, but when we talk about a girdle, it's the associated bones to its articulation with the axial skeleton. So in this case, the girdle attaches the bones of the upper extremities to the axial skeleton. Within the girdle, we have two bones. We have the clavicle and we have the scapula. And we have to remember that the clavicle is the anterior component. And of course, you've likely already palpated the structure even last semester, correct? Simply because it's so relatively superficial and it's easy to palpate. And the clavicle articulates with the sternum at the sternoclavicular joint medially and articulates with the acromion of the scapula laterally, right? The posterior component of the girdle is the scapula. And of course, we have to remember, and we're going to learn, that it's called the scapulothoracic articulation. The scapula does not articulate with any bony structure in the axial skeleton. The scapula is actually held in place by muscle tissue. But it does move in relationship to the thorax. Therefore, we do call it somewhat of an articulation. We have to remember that. And because of this, we're going to talk a little bit about this as we go through. What's vitally important in terms of the glenohumeral joint and the scapular relationship, it's about strengthening and making sure that the structures that hold things in place are strong enough to hold it there. Quite often in pain patterns and problems with the range of motion in the shoulder, it can be actually the actual muscles of the relationship between the scapula and the thorax that can kind of be the problem. The scapula articulates with the clavicle and the humerus. And if we remember from last semester, the articulation of the scapula and the acromion, and then the acromion to the sternum, is the only bony articulation of the upper limb to the axial skeleton. So the fact that the scapula is held in place by soft tissue muscle, and that the lateral acromion and clavicle and the medial clavicle and the sternum constitutes the only bony articulation. It is actually what holds the shoulder up. So if you remember, I kind of spoke about it last semester. If you fracture the clavicle, the shoulder will drop because it's no longer held up. And we'll remember that. And we'll talk a little more about that when we get to joints. So we can see it here. The girdle is made up of both the scapula and the clavicle. We have to remember the axilla is formed here from a soft tissue perspective by this girdle and the associated soft tissue structures. So the axilla is a small pyramidal space between the upper lateral part of the chest and the medial side of the arm. Its borders are biceps brachii and coracobrachialis laterally, subscapularis and latissimus dorsi posteriorly, pectoralis major anteriorly, and serratus anterior and the thoracic cage medially. And this is one of the few times where, yeah, you need to know this. Okay, I will ask questions on it. This is one, because of the nature of what is in this axilla and the soft tissues, it's important to recognize what's going on. Did you guys access anything axillary in terms of muscle tissue, trigger points, those sorts of things? You are going to. Okay, you're going to learn this semester that, you know, when we start talking about serratus anterior and those sorts of things, you're going to access pectoralis minor, serratus anterior, up into the axilla and into the thorax. Okay? And anybody here wearing a T-shirt? Robert, come here. Take your overshirt off. I don't think I ever used you yet, have I? Nope. It's a smaller class. You see, I can see all of you now. Come on up here. Okay, turn and face the class. Yeah. Okay, so if we think about it, so you can just rest on here, I can grab both anteriorly and posteriorly soft tissue structures here, right? When we have to think that this triangle, we're just relaxing your arm, it makes it more comfortable, I'm all the way up to here, okay, quite easily. So there is a fairly large space triangle up here. Now what's important up here is I can access the glenohumeral joint here. We're going to learn about something called frozen shoulder and its relationship to the articular capsule of the glenohumeral joint when we get there. Because the glenohumeral joint actually dips down like a little teardrop on its inferior aspect. The reason for that is we need kind of a hanging joint capsule, which allows for this full range of abduction, right? So what happens is in full abduction, we do have some tension in the joint capsule. When we come into adduction, the capsule actually softens and twists. So you can get a situation where you get inflammation in that capsule, it becomes fibrotic, and it sticks. So obviously his range of motion in both an abduction and external rotation will be limited. Okay? When you get the path and you start learning about it, you'll realize there's a freezing, frozen thawing to frozen shoulder. So it stiffens up, it stays stiff, and then it thaws and gets back again. But you as a massage therapist are going to learn a treatment where you get up and friction that joint capsule. The other thing is also access, as I said, so just relax your arm all the way down. I can get all the way behind pectoralis major into pec minor. So you can see my hand is underneath pec major anteriorly. And I can also, it's a little bit difficult here, I can also get all the way to the anterior. You guys can't quite see this. Maybe we'll turn just a bit. I'm actually right into the anterior surface of the scapula. Okay, I'm actually reached around, I'm about here. I can't get all the way to here, nobody can, but and when if he were lying on the table, he'd even be more relaxed, I could get in deeper, thanks. Okay, so that's why you kind of need to know this, because you need to know the structures there, because you're going to be in here doing some things every now and then in terms of treatment or trying to resolve a trigger point that might be in this area, something like that. So get to know this area and what structures are in there, it's kind of important. Now along with that, because I just did muscle tissue, you also have the subclavian artery that passes through there into the brachial artery, which becomes the brachial artery. And you also have the more distal components of the brachial plexus that travel there now as well. And you guys are doing neuro this semester, aren't you? No, that's next. Oh, you're in two, right? Not three. Correct. Sorry. Sorry, you're in two. Right. So that'll be next semester. Okay? So you do need to know these. So we have, in light of that, then we can say that the axilla is a major function. Its major function is to provide passageway for large nerves and blood vessels, such as the brachial plexus and the subclavian artery. So we can see it here. Here's the triangle here of the axilla. So we can see posteriorly subscapularis, teres major and latissimus dorsi. We can see here the lateral border, obviously, is the proximal portion of the head of the humerus. Anteriorly, we have pec major and minor. Medially, we have serratus anterior here in the front, and then, of course, the thoracic cage itself. Everything's been reflected here. We can see pec major has been removed here. Coracal brachialis has been removed here. We can see that if we get up under here, we can see the extent of the artery as it passes through here to become the brachial, and then, of course, this distal component of the brachial plexus, which would be are the nerves that leave the C-spine, and then we'll head out to innervate all the muscles we're going to be talking about in the upper limb, right? So we also sometimes work in here for working with something called thoracic outlet syndrome, which I believe I kind of talked a little bit about last semester as well, correct? I think? maybe? I don't know. So let's do the clavicle. If you so happen to remember to bring your skeleton, you have your clavicle with you. You didn't bring your clavicle. Just your scapula. Okay? So, it is also known as the collarbone. It is designated as a long bone. Okay? Even though it's a short bone, it's a long bone. It extends from the manubrium of the sternum to the acromion of the scapula. And as I said, it is the only place where the two attach, upper limb and the exoskeleton. It is a rigid support that connects the upper limb to the trunk and props the shoulder away from the chest. So it's what allows the shoulder to stay up and back to some degree. It's movable and allows the scapula to move in the thoracic wall. So when we look at this relationship, if there's anything that affects the articulation, either at the acromion, this end, or the sternum, this end, it will affect the range of motion of the shoulder joint itself. So what I would like you to do just for the moment is partner up. Drop your pens. And one is therapist and one is patient. I would like you to place your hand approximately in, you know, near that jugular notch, which represents the sternoclavicular joint. So come up out of the notch and come up onto that one joint here of your partner. On your partner. You haven't got a partner? Is there an odd number here? No, you see you can join in with the others. Okay. All right. So once you're in there, ask your client to elevate their shoulder and depress it. Retract the shoulder and then protract the shoulder. Is there a lot more movement there than you would have thought? Yeah. A lot of movement there. Your ability to be able to do all these things requires this articulation to function properly. So anything that's going to limit that articulation is going to limit all the functions we do with the glenohumeral joint. So switch if you want to. The ratio is about 3 to 4 to 1. So for every 1 degree of movement at the sternoclavicular joint, it's about 4 degrees of movement laterally on the glenohumeral joint. So a lot greater range out here as compared to here. But again, it still affects it. I think it's 4 to 1. No, yeah, 1 to 4. So for every degree here, about 4 degrees here in terms of movement. Okay, which makes sense, right? If you think the levers can change. So the other thing that this clavicle does is transmit the force from the upper limb to the axial skeleton. So if the force is greater than its strength during a fall, the clavicle will fracture, right? So because anything that affects the arm, and this being the only bony part, it is somewhat vulnerable to fracture. Now, the interesting thing is the clavicle only has articulation at its ends, proximally and distally. And the middle of the clavicle lies suspended. So I'm recording here. So Brian's first self-defense rule is, if you are grabbed by someone and you feel you're in trouble, literally take your forehead and drive it as hard as you can into the clavicle, and it will snap like a dry twig. And unlike the movies, that individual will drop like a sack of potatoes. You can also take an elbow into the center of the clavicle or a fist, and it will break very, very easily. Yeah, just come right down to the center, and it'll snap like a twig. Yeah, right? So it's because it's suspended. So if you think about it, then therefore in football, right, someone leads with the head, gets into the shoulder, clavicle will snap, okay? Hockey, what happens quite often, I'm the defensive player, the offensive player's coming across, and I go to check the individual into the boards, and they get out of my way, and I slam into the boards with my check. What's going to happen, right? Yes, or separate. So, fractures usually are from the middle third to the lateral third, medial to the attachment of the coracoclavicular ligament, which we'll talk about when we get to joints. And the medial fragment goes up, and the lateral fragment goes down. Anybody here fractured a clavicle? Usually run into one or two that do. Okay. Because of the weight of the arm, the lateral fragment drops, and the trapezius is unable to hold up the arm, and the lateral portion goes down. So you can see here, we get the fracture here, lateral drops, this goes up. So classic clavicular fracture, the patient's shoulder is down with this tented. You literally see the medial clavicle, you'll see this tent of the skin up here like this, okay? Because it's pushing through because the shoulder's dropped. You can see the weight of the arm pulls it down and away we go. And they used to put in figure eight now they're quite often surgically just screw them all both together and then away you go. They used to just lay one on top of the other, and I would see in classroom people would have clavicular fractures, and I'd see all sorts of interesting things, clavicles that are pyramidal like this, or big bumps, one lying on top of the other. Because they used to put you in a what was called a figure eight brace that would drive the shoulders up and back like this, so the two ends would kind of come back in place, and then you'd sit like that for 6 to 8 weeks. Very common in football. See a lot of broken fractured clavicles in football. Okay, so the sternal end is large and triangular. So we can see here on mine, if we just take a look at it, we can see that one part of it's quite knobby and the other part's very flat. Right? We've got a thick and sort of triangular part and a very, very flat, thin part that we can see here. Okay? The thin part represents lateral and the triangular part represents medial. So thick, thin. Okay? Got a nice thick medial part and a very flat lateral part. So the sternal end is large and triangular, where it articulates with the manubrium of the sternum, which then makes the sternal clavicular joint. The acromial end is flattened, so its lateral aspect, where it articulates with the acromion of the scapula at the acromial clavicular joint. So when we look at a clavicle here, right, we've got this is the anterior portion of the scapula. This is the posterior. So what we get is this. It actually sits on here like this. So it actually doesn't go into it. It actually sits on top of it like that. Right? So what? Yeah, you get this sort of articulation. So it kind of comes forward like that and like so. So with that in mind, knowing this is inferior, this therefore then is a left clavicle. You can see that it's S-shaped as it moves. Right, and the fact that we can see a bit of an indentation here, this represents the inferior part. So putting that inferiorly, we now know that this is a left clavicle. The medial two-thirds of the body is convex anteriorly, and the lateral one-third is flattened and concave posteriorly. That's a typo. So if you just palpate your person next to you just for a moment, you will feel that it's this S shape, right? The medial aspect being concave anteriorly, the lateral aspect being concave posteriorly in this somewhat S shape. Now, there's configurations that are different between each individual. Some are more of an S shape, some are a little bit straighter, but ultimately we do have these curves in it. And of course, not unlike when we talked about the arches and the curves of the spine for strength, this S shape, these curves, does improve strength to the bone. Right, just like the arches that we saw the Romans created. So it just does provide some strength to it just by the sheer fact that it's S-shaped. So we can see it here. Here's the sternoclavicular joint here, this thicker triangular part that articulates here with the manubrium. And we can see here the flattened part coming here to the acromion, and where it sits on top of it to form the acromial clavicular joint. The superior surface lies just deep to the skin, and of course, as we remember from last semester, the only muscle that crosses this is platysma. So platysma does run over top of this, and because it's just platysma, which is a very thin muscle and skin, this is why the clavicle is very easy to palpate. It's very, very close to the surface of the skin. It is the only muscle, platysma is the only one, as we know, that crosses over it. The superior surface is smooth as compared to the inferior surface, because there's not anything that really attaches on here, right? It's just the skin runs over top of it. Now, the inferior surface is a bit different. It is a much rougher. So if we just think common sense, knowing a bit of anatomy now, if we're going to have an articulation here, then of course we're going to have ligaments, right? So where ligaments attach on bone, on the inferior surface, laterally anyways, we're going to have roughness here because we're going to have this ligamentous attachment. So the inferior surface is rough due to the ligaments that bind it to the first rib near the sternal end and suspend the scapula from its acromial end. So medially, we have roughness here where we have ligaments coming from the sternum upwards to hold the sternoclavicular joint. And then we have, of course, ligaments here on the lateral aspects that help with the articulation of the acromioclavicular joint here laterally, okay? And we have a number of them that hold on, which we'll go through them as we get to the joint part. We have a tubercle on here that's near the acromial end of the clavicle, and it's the attachment for the conoid ligament, which allows for passive suspension of the remainder of the upper limb. So there is a bump here. I'll show you in the picture here first. All right, we can see here that we have these acromial end here, smooth on the top, underneath. This is the under part here. So we can see that this under part, we have the conoid tubercle here, okay? And it's a bit of a bump that you can somewhat see right here. This little sort of bump right there, right? And as we said, that is running, right, with a ligament that goes for the conoid tubercle and comes up from the lower parts of the scapula, which we'll talk about when we get to the joint. So this little bump right here, okay? See it right, sort of sticking right there. As you guys can tell, I'm still suffering from something. I'm not sick, but I just still don't have any voice. I'm actually going to see an ENT in a few weeks, so hopefully I can figure out what the heck's going on. Okay, right here. All right. At the acromial end is the trapezoid line, which is attachment for the trapezoid ligament. So obviously here, because of the suspension nature of the clavicle, we need quite a number of ligaments that hold this in place. The trapezoid line, for the trapezoid ligament, of course, trapezoid would represent the shape of said ligament where it finds its attachment. And then we have a subclavian groove, which is the groove for not the subclavian artery, but for the subclavian muscle. We don't spend a lot of time on the subclavian muscle. It doesn't do a whole lot, but it is there that provides some minor rotation, which we'll talk about a little bit later, because not only did you feel, the movements that occurred on elevation and protraction, in certain movements that the shoulder does, that the glenohumeral joint, the clavicle does actually minorly rotate. That allows for the range as well. So we can see here the trapezoid line is here, and then we also have the subclavian groove here, which is for the subclavius muscle. So not much. That's about all there is to it, but fundamentally it suspends the whole upper limb into the axial skeleton. Right, we have the large medial aspect, the more flattened lateral aspect, smooth superior surface, and we have some lumps and bumps here for the conoid tubercle, the subclavian groove, and then, of course, the trapezoid line as well for the trapezoid ligament. Now, I've got, how many do I have, actually? What are the only ones I have? I have a few more here. I do have some extra scapulas if anybody wants to borrow one. I'll keep this one. I have three here if anybody wants to. You shot one. You guys don't have one here. Ow. You guys can kind of try to share one. They've got some back there, so they're laughing. See how thin that is? You wonder how nobody ever, how they never break, right? Okay. So, the scapula. We've talked about it, I think, a little bit in palpation class, so you have a sense of it now already. It is a very large triangular bone. It is considered a flat bone, right? It's thin and translucent, and at the borders, it's thicker. So if you hold the real one up to the light, you can actually somewhat see through the scapula in its major part of its body. but the outer edges are very, very thick and strong. So as I was saying, you know, you'd think that, you know, a good impact in there, you'd think it would break quite easily because it's so thin, right? But there's a lot of muscle that does attach here. It has a concave costal surface. So we have to remember that when we look at the spine of the scapula and the suprascapular fossa and infrascapular fossa, this is all the posterior part. So the bumpy part actually sits posterior. It is this smooth costal part that sits anteriorly. So it sits like so, right? So you get that large smooth area that sits anteriorly against the thoracic cage. And because it does sit against the thoracic cage, it is called the costal surface, because costal represents the rib cage, right? Okay. So it has a concave costal surface. And this, you can see how concave it actually is. I don't know how well it is on the fake ones, but you can see it's relatively concave here, right? And this is known as the subscapular fossa. This whole area is known as the subscapular fossa and is the attachment for a muscle called subscapularis. Okay? Subscapular fossa. The neat thing you're going to find about the scapula, the structural names of the bone somewhat name the muscles that find attachment there. Okay? So the subscapular fossa is the attachment site for subscapularis. It is subscapularis that's very responsible for holding this against the rib cage tightly. Okay? Who we got here? Who can I grab? Come on up. Have you guys done a scapular lift yet? Okay. This won't hurt, I promise. Okay. It's going to freak them out, but it won't hurt. Okay. So, as you know, I'm going to lower Apple here for me. We can do this, right, to find the scapula. When you're actually tight, this might not work so well. Okay, bring your arm down. Okay. So, because the scapula does not articulate with a thoracic cage, but is held in place by muscles, obviously there's only certain points where muscles can hold on. So, I can actually grab the scapula and pull it off, and I can get right underneath it. Right? He's tight, actually. I should be able to take that off much more. So I'm right underneath his scapula. Right? And I do scapular lifts all the time. It feels really good. It looks kind of wild, but it feels kind of good, doesn't it?
A little weird.
It's weird, okay? So in some cases, like, see, I can get and pull that right off. Okay, because the scapula, can you turn just a little tiny bit? So you can see how far in I am. Okay, good. Thank you. Because it's held in by muscles, you can pull it up to some degree. So it's held in place, but it's not held in place. That's normal. Well, he's a little bit tight. You're going to find patients, you can't even get underneath the scapula, and they'll likely have a shoulder problem. It is normal. The scapula should be able to lift off. In fact, in some females, I can almost wing it all the way out if the muscles are soft enough, like they're not too, too tight. So it's a normal, yes. Generally, you have a greater range, better range of motion. Under the influence of estrogen and progesterone, tendons and ligaments tend to be much more pliable in females than they are in males. I think it's because you're set up to want to have the ligaments here nice and loose when it's time to have a baby, right? So I think it influences it to some degree. But you will find patients where you can't even get under the scapula, and that becomes their problem. If you can't lift that scapula, then its range of motion in its relationship to the thoracic cage will limit how much the actual glenohumeral joint can move. And we'll look at some more examples of that. So when we talk about this subscapular fossa and subscapularis, this is a muscle that holds that against the thoracic cage. Now, the scapula is a very mobile bone, and it needs to be, because it has a direct relationship to the glenohumeral joint. Here's the problem. When we look at the relationship of the humerus to the scapula, we're going to learn that, of course, the humerus is a ball and socket joint, right? We kind of alluded to that last semester. The proximal humerus is the ball. This little tiny concavity here is known as the glenoid fossa. That's the socket. Now, when we compare the shoulder to the hip, again, we have a ball, but note, I'm jumping ahead here a bit, but this will all come back. If we look at the two, it is pretty much a complete ball on the femur, correct? Is it a complete ball on the humerus? No, not near as complete, correct? It's almost half, correct? All right. When we compare the scapula to the ilium or the coxal bone, we have the glenoid fossa here. How deep is that? And then we have the acetabulum here. How deep is that? Very deep. So when we place the femur in here, we can see, and there's a labrum that goes around here, but you can see this relatively deep. So there's a problem with having it this deep. The range of motion of this joint as compared to this joint is entirely different. The term is the shoulder gave up stability for mobility. So the fact that it is a much shallower fossa and a less round ball allows for this vast range of motion that our glenohumeral joint actually has. All right, so it gave it up. Okay, so because of that, there's a problem. We have this thing here called an acromion. So in abduction, what's going to happen? Bonk. Right? There's a problem here. So what has to happen is there has to be scapular rotation in abduction. And the reason for the scapular rotation is so that the congruency or association between the ball of the humerus and the socket of the scapula remain in perfect harmony. So that when this is going up, this rotates with it and allows that range to increase. Because if it just stood there, it would jam and you wouldn't get very far at all. Okay? All right? So what I want you to do is, again, stand up, partner up. Seeing as you're by yourself, you can come on up here and you can be Vanna. Who's Vanna, right? Come on. You don't know who Vanna White is? Okay. Come on over here. No, you can turn your back to them. Come to me. Okay. I'm going to move your hair out of the way. All right. You're not going to be able to see it, but you're going to be able to feel it. And you can do this in lab too. What I would like you to do, because I know you've already kind of palpated it, you're going to feel around, find that scapula, find that inferior angle, superior angle, and so forth. Okay. What I would like you to do is get to, did you guys do this in lab? Did you make like the V with your CNR web to get into the inferior angle? Okay. I'm going to get a little bit, you okay if I kind of grab you, however? Okay. So, because I just don't want to push over. So I've got the inferior angle here, the scapula. I'm going to take my CNR web here, my thumb, and I'm going to come right underneath and just kind of surround the inferior angle. Okay. Once I kind of have that, I'd like you to abduct for me. Relax. Okay. Try one more time, just the left one. Okay, and I want you to get a sense of the rotation that's happening. So just find that inferior angle, and you can stay here or you can just grab it with your fingers, whichever you prefer, and ask your patient to abduct and adduct, and get a sense of how much movement's occurring there, all right? Just watch your breast tissue, that's all. Be kind of careful with that. You're going to stay here, I'm not done with you yet. Yes. Okay. Now you've done that. Nope. Stay standing. You're not done yet. I don't care which one. Again, one's therapist, one's patient. Therapist. I would like you, when you palpate, turn your back to them again. When you palpate the scapula, I want you to try to hold it in place when they abduct. Now, I'm going to do it first. So let's just do normal abduction. Go as far as you can. And good. Okay. Normal range. Thank you. You can come down. Now I'm going to take the scapula and I'm going to hold it. Go ahead. See? That's as far as you can go. So give it a try. Try to hold the scapula. See how much range you get. Start down. No, start down and then see how much you get. Okay. You got to hold it pretty firmly. It's got to be firm. Okay. So, now you can have a seat. Not you. I'm going to use you and abuse you here for a while. Therefore, because the scapula is basically held where it is by muscle tissue, we have to remember, I'm just going to have you turn around again. Remember, this faces this way, right? That's the scapula. And the only bony articulation is between the clavicle at the acromion and the manubrium. So this floats, and as we say, has a lot of range of motion. So therefore, any muscle that's associated with this scapula, especially on its anterior surface, any problem with it will limit its rotation and its relationship to the humerus, which will result in a reduction in range of motion of the shoulder itself. So if a patient's coming to you today and they have shoulder problems, and during your range of motion assessment, you are seeing lack of range in this shoulder joint, you now have a much bigger picture to consider. A, is it the relationship between the humerus and the scapula, bony, that's causing the lack of range of motion? B, is there tissue damage that's causing the lack of range of motion? And C, is there weakness or tightness in the muscles that attach and affect the movement of the scapula that's reducing the range of motion? So when I was doing the lift, and I was talking about how, you know, you should be able to get it out to here, and if some people I couldn't even get under the scapula, they're going to have a reduction in range of motion of the shoulder simply because that tightness, that scapula's range, is not going to function properly. Thank you. I'm with you. Okay? So it's something to consider. So when we say, you know, it is a very mobile bone, it has to be. Functionally, it has to be. And when it doesn't, the shoulder doesn't function properly. Now, on the posterior surface, it's not so flat. There's something that runs right through the middle of the scapula, and this is known as the spine. And I'm sure you palpated that last semester. Did you do the spine of the scapula? Okay. So the spine divides the posterior scapula into a superior portion and an inferior portion. Okay? Superior and inferior. But the spine itself continues laterally to form the acromion. So the spine starts medially here at what level? T2. And runs laterally where it then extends and flattens out to form the acromion. Now when you do the scapula, you're looking at it like this, right? You sort of put it in this up and down thing like this. It needs to be like that, okay, because your thoracic cage goes like this and this surrounds it. So the orientation of the scapula is actually like this. And you can see how the acromion comes into the right place for the clavicle to sit on top. When it's like this, it doesn't work so much. It actually sits like this, which allows for the acromion to come in, okay? So the spine divides the posterior scapula into a superior part and an inferior part. It arises from the medial aspect of the medial surface or border of the scapula, goes laterally where it expands out into and forms the acromion, which is that flattened part here. Now, can I bore you for a sec? Funny, Michelle and I were just talking about this the other day. When, I should bring it in, I'll bring it in on break. If you guys got your McGee's now, right? Your McGee assessment book, you know how thick it is? My assessment book when I went to massage school was about this thick. Okay, and his name was Hoppenfeld. But what I liked about Hoppenfeld wasn't so much the testing. Hoppenfeld does a great job of introducing you to assessment, and he talks about when we landmark. So you've already done some landmarking, and you discussed it in palpation. But what I liked about Hoppenfeld was he had key points where if you're palpating structures and getting a sense of where you're at, there were places to lay your hand. So if we just look out here and we follow the clavicle laterally, the clavicle will take you out to the acromion every time, right? So, you know, you get this thickened part here at the manubrial sternal joint. Sternoclavicular joint, and you're going to come laterally and you'll feel it flatten out into the acromioclavicular joint, right? As soon as you come off that lateral clavicle, you'll sit right on top of the acromion, this sort of this flat table that's sitting here. So what Hoppenfeld always talked about and I liked, when you're doing palpations in the shoulder, I'm just going to have you sit because it's a bit easier. Your key place to start is there. Just put your hand right there. Now from there, I can palpate everything. I can follow the clavicle. I can come up trapezius. I can fall down the spine to the scapula. I can palpate the acromioclavicular joint. I can come down here and I can feel the humerus. Right, I can feel deltoid. It's just a nice place to start. So when you're doing, and talk to Michelle about this, and she might say, "Oh, it's Brian telling you now," because she may not do this, but just simply, doesn't that seem easy? If I'm going to palpate the shoulder, I just put my hand here, and I can go everywhere. My thumb's out here to the superior angle. You know, my fingers are here on the clavicle. I can drop off the acromioclavicular joint. I can drop down here to the humerus. It's just a nice place to be. Have you stand up again? And just as a sidebar, he also talks about if you're doing hip joint, just come right in here to the iliac crest, and from here you can go everywhere, right? Back to the PSIS, anteriorly to the ASIS, right, and so on and so forth. So just try to remember that. It's kind of key points to start. Thank you. So again, the spine is a thick ridge which continues laterally to form the acromion, which again is the point of the shoulder where the lateral clavicle and the acromion articulate to form the acromioclavicular joint. So we can see it here. Here is the anterior portion here, the subscapular fossa that sits here. And again, you know, we have to remember, sometimes you forget, the anterior surface, although we see it here and we talk about the lateral border, we can't see it anatomically because we have a rib cage that sits right in front of it, right? And as I showed you, you can somewhat palpate the anterior surface, but not quite so much of it, but it's there. The lateral edge here, we can see the convexity of it, we can see the convexity of it here where it articulates with the thoracic cage, which of course then results in the costal surface. Posteriorly here, we can see that the spine of the scapula is dividing it into superior, inferior parts, and coming out here to form the acromion process, which of course is the place where the lateral clavicle and the acromion articulate at the acromioclavicular joint. You can see its relationship here to the thoracic cage, and of course the scapula doesn't sit directly on the thoracic cage because there's lots of anterior musculature. There are two major muscles. The first is subscapularis, which we've talked about. There's another muscle as well, though, that comes all the way around from the lateral aspect of the rib cage, goes all the way around posteriorly to attach on the medial surface of the anterior scapula. So again, here's the anterior scapula. Picture a muscle that comes down over here and comes around and attaches only here on this part from down here, right? And that is known as serratus anterior. We'll get to those later. But that's what helps hold this in, and they fill in this part here. You can see here as well, you can see a bit of that costal surface groove as well here. Medially, the root of the spine is at T3. I was wrong when I said T2. T2 is where the superior angle is, not the spine. I made that mistake. So medially, the root of the spine is at T3. So where the root or where the spine starts, we call this the root of the spine here on the medial border of the scapula. Superior to the spine is the fossa. And because it's above the spine, it's called the supraspinous fossa. Supraspinous above the spine, and it's a fossa. So it sits up here above the spine, supraspinous fossa. Below the spine is the larger infraspinous fossa. So you have a fossa above the spine, supraspinous, and you have a fossa below the spine, infraspinous. Okay? So small supra, very large infra. That lies underneath, okay? And there's various muscles that attach there. In fact, someone has drawn with a pencil here, the muscles that attach there, which I'll use a little bit later. Superolaterally, the scapula forms the shallow glenoid cavity for articulation with the head of the humerus to form the glenohumeral joint. So we can see here, we've got the spine, we have the supraspinous fossa, the infraspinous fossa, and then laterally, it extends out to form the glenoid fossa, which we can see here, sometimes are also called the glenoid process. So the glenoid fossa would sit in the glenoid process, which sits here. So, as I showed you before, that glenoid fossa, of course, is the concavity to take on the convexity of the proximal head of the humerus, form the glenohumeral joint. The coracoid process, as I said, is superior to the glenoid cavity and projects anterolaterally. So we've got this coracoid process. So we've got the lateral border here that comes and forms a glenoid process with the glenoid fossa. And then anteriorly off of the glenoid fossa, above the glenoid fossa, we have this extension that comes out here. And this is known as the coracoid process. Our number of muscles that attach here. And just as a palpation, you're going to learn a palpation class, because it sticks out, you can actually feel it just under the lateral clavicle. It's like a finger that points right back at you, which is the attachment for coracobrachialis and various ligaments, especially ligaments that hold the lateral aspect of the clavicle onto the acromion in its relationship. Okay, so you've got the shallow glenoid cavity for articulation with the head of the humerus, and then you have the coracoid process that's just superior to the glenoid cavity that projects anterior laterally, which is the attachment point for coracobrachialis and various ligaments, and that's this piece right here. So here we are here. You can see the acromion here coming off the spine. We have the superior angle and inferior angle here. And I don't put these much in the lectures because I know you already know them. You've gone through them last semester. We can see here's the glenoid fossa here. And then we have the coracoid process sticking out here with the acromion. Now, we do have these borders. We have a couple of other things that are kind of important here. So there are medial, lateral, and superior borders. And you should do, for sure, you probably already palpated the lateral and medial borders last semester, yes or no? Okay, so you will be doing it in lab next week. So because we think of, the fact that this is held by soft tissue, we can easily palpate the lateral border and the medial border here. A little more difficult, the superior angle we can get, but the superior border is sometimes somewhat difficult to get at, okay? Can somewhat get at it. The superior angle lies at T2, and the inferior angle lies at T7. So we have T2 for the superior angle, T3 for the root of the spine of the scapula, and T7 for the inferior angle. And I think you've probably already done that last semester, yes? Probably uses a bit of a orientation as landmarks, right? T2, T3, T7. Okay. I think I did talk last semester about the position of the scapula when you're doing that, correct? Yeah, which is the vital mistake. That's why I'm bringing it up. Yes, you do this to find the scapula, but then you must come here to do the proper palpations. Because when you do this, the scapula rotates and goes superiorly. So I've had many students in OPs when they're doing their palpation and they're doing the scapula, they'll continue the palpation in this position and they're off. And they get angry at me when I say, sorry, you didn't palpate it. You've got it. You can do this to find the scapula, but you must go back to here to do the palpation appropriately because the scapula will come down and sit in the appropriate position for T2, T3, and T7. Okay? Everybody follow that? All right. The lateral angle is the thickest part of the scapula where it becomes the head of the scapula where the glenoid cavity is located. So if you look at this one, you can see here that this lateral border is very, very thick compared to the rest of the scapula, and it does form the head, which is part of the glenoid fossa. Okay? The medial border runs parallel to the spinous processes of the thoracic spine, hence the reason why we can use it for a landmark to find thoracic vertebra if we're doing palpations, right? T2, T3, and T7, and then count accordingly from there. So we can see here, we've got lateral border here, superior border here, medial border here. We have the superior angle, the inferior angle. This is anteriorly here, so therefore this is the subscapular fossa that we see here. Here is the coracoid process here that's coming out anteriorly, and just behind it is this flat part, which is the acromion. The lateral border runs from the inferior angle to the apex of the axilla. So it does come up quite a bit. The superior border runs from the superior angle to the suprascapular notch and is the thinnest and shortest. So between the superior border, at the superior border between the superior angle and the coracoid process, you'll see that there's a very deep notch here that sits in, quite a deep notch here, and this is known as the suprascapular notch. It's not really palpable, but it is there. The glenoid cavity is a shallow concave oval surface, which we just sort of went through here when we were comparing it to the hip. It faces anterolaterally and slightly superior. So you have to consider that when we say that it lies, it faces anterolaterally and slightly up. Okay, anterolaterally and slightly up, which is the normal place where it fits nicely into the ball of the proximal humerus. It is the articulation of the head of the humerus and the glenoid fossa, of course, that forms this glenohumeral joint, which, of course, we know is the shoulder joint. So they're the two that come together to form the shoulder joint. There are two tubercles in relationship to the glenoid fossa. There is a tubercle superior to the glenoid fossa, known as the supraglenoid tubercle, which is for long head biceps brachii. There is a tubercle inferior to the glenoid fossa, the infraglenoid tubercle, which is the attachment site for triceps brachii. So biceps comes up and attaches here. Triceps attaches here. Okay? Supra for bi, infra for tri. Okay? There are both sites for muscle attachments, and the scapula has the ability to move quite freely along the posterior thoracic wall, forming this scapulothoracic joint. So you'll see that in my slides. I believe it's called the SUT joint. I kind of made a short form for it because it's in the textbook like that. So a muscle may affect the scapulothoracic joint because we have to consider it as a joint because it is an articulation between the two structures, and there are muscles that do affect that relationship. And as we've just noted here when we are working together, it is this scapulothoracic joint that allows for the full range of the shoulder joint. And without this nice movement of the scapula, you're not going to get full range of motion of the shoulder itself.
Could you repeat the muscle attachment for?
We're going to get back to it, don't worry. At this point, I wouldn't ask you the question on it. So when we get to those muscles at all, it'll come up a little bit more. Because I also have to talk about, at some point, that anybody here ever had a slap lesion? Anybody here had a slap lesion? So part of the tendon from long head biceps actually forms a labrum that goes around the upper part of the joint. And in some sports, the long head tendon will pull that labrum off and sort of tear it off. And I've had two students, I think, in my time here, where they've had to go in surgically and they take cartilage from around the hip joint and they build a new labrum because it's been ripped off. It's called a slap lesion. So we can see here that all the movements that can occur, we can elevate the scapula, depress the scapula, adduct the scapula, where they're going this way, right? We can separate them like this. We can have all these various movements that occur, and we require all of them in order for the shoulder joint or the glenohumeral joint to function in the full range that it does. The muscles do hold the scapula in place. Now, there can be a situation where a muscle is weakened. Could be that there's damage to a nerve, for example, and it can form what is called the winged scapula. So the long thoracic nerve innervates a muscle called serratus anterior, and the serratus anterior, along with subscapularis, holds the scapula tight to the thoracic cage. If there's any damage to the long thoracic nerve, this muscle can no longer hold the scapula tight to the thoracic cage. And because when it's weakened, and although it wings, It also will not be able to rotate, so this patient will have no abduction, and it looks like this. So you can see that the subscapularis and serratus anterior are working just fine, thank you very much, on the left side of this patient, but on the right side, there's weakness to this muscle, and you can see what's happened to the scapula. And you can see that it pops right out here, and just standing there, it'll pop out. There is a test for it. You have the patient's shirt off. You ask them to stand against the wall and put their body weight on here. If there's a winged scapula, once they put the body weight on it, that scapula will pop right out in that position. Some people have it naturally because they just happen to have very mobile soft tissues, and they will have one side that's winged a little bit more to the other. Any questions on that? See, when you know what you know, how much easier it is. Think of the first week you were here and I was doing all this stuff and you're like, what in the hell is he talking about? I don't know what he's talking about. The semester ones are feeling that right now. I might ask a couple of you to come in and talk to them just to allay their fears. No, they have A&P with me on Mondays and they have clinical anatomy on Thursdays from 5 till 8. They were supposed to, but I had the schedule changed. They were supposed to do them back to back on Thursdays. Yeah, 1 to 4 was A&P, and 5 to 8 was supposed to be clinical anatomy. And I'm like, I can't do that to them because they have lab this morning at 8 o'clock. Imagine that schedule. They all be crying, ready to jump off the roof. Okay, so we did bones, and as usual, now we're going to do joints. So the sternoclavicular joint, that would be the articulation of the sternum, well, the manubrium, and the clavicle. And as I said previously, it is the only bony articulation between the upper limb and the axial skeleton. It is a saddle joint. What movements can occur here? Oh, God, Brian, you're not asking the stuff from last semester, are you? Yep. What movements occur at a saddle joint? Well done. Everything except internal and external rotation. All right? So that means it does what? Flex, extend. All right? Bit of rotation. Okay? So the medial clavicle articulates in a shallow socket formed by the superolateral manubrium and its first costal cartilage. I unfortunately do not have a manubrium in my little box here. I never did have one. I wish I could, but I have one, but I can't show it to you. So we can see here that we've got, it's in place here with its joint capsule. We can see it's cut away here. Same on this, we can see that we're saying here, it is a saddle joint where the medial clavicle articulates in a shallow socket formed by the superolateral manubrium and the first costal cartilage, all right? So here is, here it's sitting here as far as that one. Here's the first costal cartilage. So the first rib comes into the lateral aspect of the manubrium here. Right? So right in here, you can see the first rib's coming in, and then, of course, it has its costal cartilage. Remember the costal cartilages, right? The rib doesn't go directly into. It has the costal cartilage. So we're saying it partially articulates with the costal cartilage here and then this shallow groove here in the superior manubrium. Okay? So superolateral manubrium, first costal cartilage. The articular surfaces are fibrocartilaginous. Okay, not hyaline. Is a saddle, but it functions as a ball and socket. So we can see here that it is a synovial joint. You can see the joint capsule up there, and you can see it sort of in this light. So the first is, again, one of the modifications this joint has is a disc. Okay, so within this joint space, there is a disc. Now, the disc separates the articulation between the two into two separate synovial cavities. And what's happening here? Hello? Did you turn it off? Maybe my battery died. Trying to. Uh-oh. No, we still got 15 minutes. That's weird. Your battery is running low. There you go. I'll get batteries on break. I need 2 AAAs. What? May I ask why you're carrying 2 AAAs?
Well, I used to have one of those, so I had backups in my...
Do you think they're any good?
Yeah, they're good. They're better
than what I've got right now, you're right.
Actually, I probably have another one.
It's okay if it works.
Some of them are probably good and some of them are probably not good.
Well, I'll find out here. Hey! Okay, so we can see here, the disk is lying here and divides it into 2 spaces. You can also see it in this diagram as well. So the disk separates the joint into 2 separate spaces. It's attached superiorly to the clavicle and inferiorly to the junction of the first costal cartilage in the sternum. So it actually doesn't float. It's actually attached superiorly to the clavicle itself. So you can see here, it's attached here to the clavicle itself. Inferiorly down there, you can see that it's attached at the junction of the first costal cartilage and the manubrium. So you can see how the disc divides it into 2 separate synovial spaces. It is continuous with posterior and anterior sternoclavicular ligaments. So we'll see here that we've got, here's your anterior sternoclavicular ligament here. And behind there, posteriorly, you would have a posterior sternoclavicular ligament. And, of course, the name tells you exactly what it's related to, right? It's a ligament that helps support the sternoclavicular joint. Its purpose, it prevents medial dislocation of the clavicle. So, believe it or not, it is so strong that, again, if we go back to the hockey analogy, if I'm going to lay a check into the board and I hit hard enough, and I drive my shoulder medially, the acromial clavicular joint will disrupt before the sternoclavicular joint does. So in other words, if we had the two here, if the shoulder is strikes laterally, this joint won't disrupt. The clavicle will actually do this, right? Oh, sorry, this way. Apologies. So the impact will push the scapula, and this is strong enough that it won't be disrupted at all. So it's a very, very strong joint. It also acts as a shock absorber for forces transferred along the clavicle, and it is so strong that the clavicle will fracture before this joint actually dislocates. So it's a very strong, powerful joint. It makes sense, right? If it's supporting the whole upper limb just at this attachment, it better be strong, right? It compensates for superior overlap of the clavicle on the sternum. Obviously, the way the clavicle sits on top of the acromion, it ain't the strongest joint. So this is a very, very powerful joint. So we can see here we've got, again, this disc that divides into 2 synovial spaces attached to these 2 points, and then we have anterior and posterior sternoclavicular ligaments. The anterior sternoclavicular ligament is thickening of the fibrous joint capsule, therefore it is an intrinsic ligament because it provides fibers to the capsule around the joint. The posterior sternoclavicular ligament, of course, is the same as above. It thickens of the fibrous joint capsule, so it too is an intrinsic ligament. And both the anterior and posterior sternoclavicular ligaments firmly attached to the disc, holding it in place. Okay, so they're all connected, which provides all this strength that we're talking about. We also have the interclavicular ligament, and I like this picture better. So here is your anterior sternoclavicular, your posterior behind, and then in that jugular groove that you're palpating between the two medial aspects of the clavicles, you have the interclavicular ligament that helps support as well. We then have the costoclavicular ligament. It is extracapsular or extrinsic. It goes from the first costal cartilage to the medial clavicle, and this limits elevation of the medial clavicle. So it sits right here. So from the costal cartilage to the medial aspect of the proximal clavicle, it's going to prevent that clavicle medially from getting too high. So in when you are elevating, and yes, the clavicle was elevating as well, this ligament was actually getting taut and preventing the medial clavicle from getting too high. Oops, what did I do there? Sorry, guys. Okay, so it's from the first costal cartilage to the medial clavicle, and as I said, any elevation of the clavicle will result in this ligament becoming taut. And you can see it in this drawing as well. Here it is sitting here between the costal cartilage and the inferior aspect of the proximal clavicle. Here's your articular disc, and you can see how it's firmly attached to these structures, and along with this anterior, and of course what we can't see, the posterior sternoclavicular ligaments holding it in place, and you can nicely see how they put the interclavicular ligament that runs here between the two. So, synovial membranes, of course there are two because the disc has divided it into two separate synovial spaces. So we have two synovial membranes, and the synovial membranes line the surface of the disc and the articular surfaces itself. So how does it move here? It allows the clavicle a 60-degree angle from the anatomical position. That 60 degrees is the lateral aspect of the clavicle. You know, if you think about it, when we're looking at it, if I do this, as far as that goes, when we are thinking of the medial aspect here of the clavicle, this part out here gets to the large degree of movement, but not the proximal aspect, right, when we're elevating. So, and you should have felt that when you had your patient elevating. So 60 degrees of angle on the distal clavicle superior from the anatomical position. It moves with movement of the scapula, so the scapula would be moving at the same time, obviously. It can also move anteriorly or posteriorly of a range up to 25 to 30 degrees. So it is relatively movable, just limited to some degree with elevation. It acts like the apex of a cone in movement of the upper limb. So if you were to kind of somebody do this, you know, a circular sort of thing, you would note that this is kind of moving along with it, but at a much smaller range as compared to the distal parts of the clavicle. Stability is largely the disc and the ligaments that hold it all into place. There, if you think about it, there's very little muscle support here. There's not too much attaching to the clavicle, proximally. So the body relies on ligamentous tissues and the disc itself, the fact that it's strongly anchored on both aspects of the joint to hold this in place. It is a bony incongruence. It's not the most well-fit joint, but again, the ligaments help keep it in place. So we can see here that we have this axis here. We have two axes moving here, one this way, held into place here. And then we can see that its relationship to elevation and depression and so forth. The other part that needs to occur here, you do get posterior rotation that does have to happen in order for all these movements to occur as well. It's a very small rotation, but it needs to be there, and without it, it won't function properly. So any kind of arthritic condition or significant damage to this joint and its relationship to the manubrium will obviously directly affect the ability of the shoulder itself to go through its full range. We're going to head out now to the acromioclavicular joint. So we're heading out into the relationship between the lateral clavicle and the acromion of the scapula. It is a plain synovial joint, so it slides and glides. It is between the lateral clavicle and the acromion of the scapula, 2 to 3 centimeters from the lateral point of the acromion. So we can see how it sits out here like this. So fundamentally, it kind of sits on top of the acromion that we can see here. It is a fibrocartilaginous joint. It slopes inferomedially, and the clavicle tends to override the acromion as in the AC, as in AC joint separation. So I kind of always over-exaggerate it so that you can see it, but it does actually sit ever so slightly just above like so, right? When we're looking at it, it's kind of like that, just ever so slightly over top. So what I'd like you for the moment to do is, again, grab your partner. I want you to follow the clavicle out laterally and see if you can feel the step off of the lateral clavicle onto the acromion. There's a little tiny drop off at the very end. Oh, you've had one? Oh, it's really obvious then. It's got a, do you know what grade it was? It must have been a grade 1 then. They didn't do anything for a grade 3? So 3 can be a complete disruption. Between. No, that's what I mean. So, oh, he, you said he had a step deformity. Oh, apologies. Oh, he shouldn't, though. Well, I guess you'd get a little bit of it. So it was probably a grade 3 where he didn't completely disrupt.
Yeah.
Would have had the damage, but not done. Okay, you can feel it now. It's quite obvious. You can actually feel the step off. Okay, now what I'd like you to do is I want you to stabilize your patient, and I'd like you to grab the distal clavicle anteriorly and posteriorly. Come on up. Probably easier to see. Okay, you're going to grab the clavicle, you're going to follow it along, follow the step off, and I want you to glide it and slide it. I want you to feel it move. You can actually slide it along. Can you feel it moving?
Yes.
Yep. You can actually move it. I want you to try to move it anteriorly, posteriorly. It's not bad. It's supposed to. You got to get in there. It's a bit. You got to get in there and do it. I know. You're like, yeah, I can feel it move. So it's just really right along that edge, anteriorly, posteriorly. Not yourself, your partner. Good Lord. It's easy to do it on yourself. You're going to have to stabilize the whole upper arm to do it. Otherwise, the whole shoulder is going to go back and forth. Some of you might find it's crunchy. Again, if this joint isn't functioning properly, the shoulder will be limited in its function. Gross. You're going to be doing joint mobilizations this semester, which means you're actually going to be moving joints. Sure. We just got your first kind of thing on it, right? Reminds me. Did we do accessory movements last semester? A little bit. I might bring the pie plates in next week. Remind me to bring the pie plates in next week. So, it's got a disc in it as well. So, but it's not the same as what we see in the proximal joint. It's an incomplete disc. So the disc is wedge shaped. It's fibrocartilaginous. It's an incomplete disc. So it only partially divides the two. So you can see we have a partial disc here. We don't have two separate synovial spaces. We have one that's partially divided, right? So we still have a disc in here. You can kind of see a little bit of the disc here. Obviously, even though it's a glide, slide glide joint or a plane joint, you know, it is a synovial joint, so therefore it's got fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, synovial fluid with this disc and so forth. And you can see that it's highly movable and it needs to be. When this joint is disrupted, it is called a shoulder separation. So when there's a disruption between the lateral clavicle and the acromion, this is known as a shoulder separation. There are 3 grades to a shoulder separation, the worst being grade 3, where basically the acromion rips right off, or the lateral clavicle rips right off the acromion and doesn't even attach anymore. And then various degrees of soft tissue damage depending on grade 1, grade 2. Again, a very common hockey injury with checking. Can see it here. We've got the capsule here. We've got the disc. Although they show it solid, it's really not. As I said, it's only partial. and we have supporting ligaments, which we'll talk about after we're done the joint capsule on a break. So the joint capsule is sleeve-like and relatively loose because we need this range. The fibrous layer is attached to the margins of the articular surfaces. And what's interesting is trapezius actually strengthens this joint superiorly. So fibers of upper trapezius actually strengthen this joint to some degree above, because when we talk about upper trapezius, we talked a little bit about it last semester, but we're going to get into a bit more. It actually does this funky twisty thing over top of the acromion as it heads up. Okay, take a break. We'll see you guys at about 10:02. Oh, let's continue. Let him jump ahead a little bit there, but that's okay because you get reinforcement both ways. So the acromioclavicular joint, of course, we said, it's out to the clavicle. Now, as he alluded to there, and you saw some of the diagram or some of the movements of the cadaver, there are powerful ligaments that are out here in this lateral aspect that hold things together. So we have what are called acromioclavicular ligaments. And quite often, they're actually thickenings of the joint capsule itself. So, of course, they're said to be intrinsic. And what they do is prevent this overriding that can occur of the clavicle on top of the acromion. So the first is called the coracoclavicular ligament. Where does that tell you it is? From the what to the what? From the coracoid process to the clavicle, right? There's two parts to it. They're considered to be the strongest ligaments, and they are extrinsic and medial to the joint itself. So here you can see here from the coracoid process, right, to the acromion here. We also have here from the coracoid to the clavicle. So we can see that they're the coracoid process is deliberately here, with this bent finger that sticks out, and we can see that the ligaments lie here. So the coracoclavicular go from the coracoid process to the clavicle. There's two of them. And remember we had the conoid sulcus, or the part of the underside of the of the clavicle. The coronoid ligament, it does go straight up, and it travels somewhat medially to the trapezoid and then twists in upon itself, whereas the trapezoid is almost horizontal in the frontal plane, and they check the lateral movement of the clavicle on the acromion. So we can see here is the, we've got the trapezoid ligament here coming from the coracoid process to the underside of the clavicle, and then we have the conoid here. So again, a little more horizontal the trapezoid as compared to more vertical of the conoid. What we can see here, they're on the lateral aspect of the clavicle, and they really do hold the clavicle in relationship to the acromion itself. So again, conoid is medial to the trapezoid. It does do a little twist on itself to attach, and then the trapezoid's a little more lateral, which we can see here. Right, here's our two here. We've got the trapezoid here and the conoid here in this diagram. And here's the trapezoid and the conoid here that we can see here. So from the coracoid process up to the underside of the actual clavicle itself, okay? Checking that movement that's occurring. The other one is the coracoacromial. I haven't got yet. That's probably coming up. So this acromioclavicular joint, these ligaments help prevent excessive narrowing of the angle between the acromion and the clavicle. So when we look at the movement of the scapula, we want the movement to occur, and we do have a ligament, as we found out, between the manubrium and the clavicle that prevents it gets taut on elevation. These two also help prevent the angle from changing too much. So there are no muscles that connect to the articulating bones that actually react to the acromioclavicular joint itself. The muscles affect the scapula, but not the AC joint. The AC joint reacts to any movements of the scapula that are created by the muscles themselves. So we say that no muscle connects to the articulating bones to move the AC joint. It is the muscles that move the scapula that causes the acromion to move on the clavicle. Now, there is a bit of rotation. I alluded to it previously before you went on break. When there is abduction, the scapula rotates, and so too does a bit of the clavicle itself. But did you see he was doing the rotations there? Did you notice the rotations of the scapula? So when I go into abduction, we do have to have that lateral rotation. So that inferior angle travels laterally in rotation in order to allow for that full range of motion. And like he said, true abduction goes to here, and then it's the scapula that continues to the full amount. Okay? Now, when we're doing range of motion of the shoulder in assessment, what we normally have the patient do is go into this position here, and then we have them rotate and then finish, which takes a little bit of, because if we don't, you can see here that if we get so far, we actually get the jamming of the bone. If we rotate, we move it a little bit out of the way. So we're able to get a little bit more with it. But we still require that scapular rotation to occur for full abduction. So usually what you do is to here and then rotate, and then you can finish. And then the full finish is the scapular rotation itself that finishes so that you can actually bring the hands right together above the head. Right? Because this joint's gone as far as it can. Now it's scapular rotation that finishes it. This increases the distance between the coracoid process and the clavicle. So when we have this abduction occurring, we do get some separation of the clavicle and the coracoid process. This conoid ligament becomes tight, which causes posterior rotation of the clavicle. And the posterior rotation of the clavicle is what allows for it as well. That rotation brings the acromioclavicular joint back into apposition. So if we didn't have that bit of clavicular rotation, we wouldn't be able to have a good relationship between the lateral acromion the acromion and the lateral clavicle, which again would affect abduction. So for full abduction, we need scapular rotation, and we need rotation which allows that acromioclavicular joint to remain in an appropriate opposition to each other. It also allows the glenoid fossa in the appropriate position for the head of the humerus to move through as well. So the point is, all these small movements that occur, scapular rotation and rotation and movement of the clavicle itself, must occur for the patient to achieve full abduction when you're assessing a shoulder joint. So again, any lack of it, the question you have to ask yourself is cause, and could it be some of this stuff that's limiting your patient's range of motion when you're checking them out, okay? The scapulothoracic articulation, of course, is between the scapula and thoracic cage. I've talked about it a couple of times. It is not a true anatomic joint. The scapula is buried, as we've said, amid muscles covering the upper posterior thorax. There is no bony anchorage to the vertebral column or the thorax. There's just that acromion at the acromio-sternal joint, right? That's our point of contact. And as we said, in the resting position, the scapula lies over ribs 2 to 7 with proximal scapular spine at T3. And as you've seen here in the diagram, in the video, we talked about it a bit in class, this scapulothoracic articulation is protraction, retraction, elevation, depression, and again, the scapular rotation, which allows for AB and adduction. And we can see here all these muscles which we will be taking, trapezius, levator scapulae, rhomboids, and serratus anterior, and a bit of subscapularis, which is in here. They all affect the appropriate movements of the scapula on the thoracic cage, which allows for the full range of motion that occurs at the glenohumeral joint. That's the one thing you need to take away, okay? Where the heck am I here? There you are. All righty. is that you have to have that relationship occurring between the scapula and its rotation and the muscles that do. That's the big thing to take away, is that you can't have good range of motion of the shoulder unless that scapula is moving appropriately around the thoracic cage. Upper arm and glenohumeral joint. Go farther than I thought, so I've got to find this. Where are you? Let's see that. Shoulder and glenohumeral joint. There we go. Okay. So I am going to jump a bit ahead to the upper arm and the glenohumeral joint, because you kind of can't do one without the other. Although we've taken the clavicle and its association to the acromion, and we've taken the scapula, we do have to talk a little bit about the upper arm and the glenohumeral joint, because some of the muscles we're going to be discussing affect that as well as the scapula at the same time. So we have to deal with that. So, of course, are you guys okay? Do you want me to turn the lights on? Is it too dark in here? It's good? Okay. All right. So the humerus. Obviously, it's a long bone, like the femurs. It is the largest bone in the upper limb. It's a little bit larger than the bones in the forearm. And it goes from the shoulder to the elbow, so it helps create the shoulder joint proximally and the elbow joint distally. The proximal epiphysis has a smooth ball-like head that articulates with the glenoid cavity of the scapula. And we've discussed that a couple of times this morning, where we have this articulation that's occurring here. And when we compared it to the hip joint, as I said, the shoulder gave up stability for mobility. So it's not a full sphere, but it's significantly round. Just distal to the head is the anatomical neck of the humerus. The neck separates the head from the lateral greater tubercle and the anterior lesser tubercle. So if we look here, I'll do the diagram as well. We can see here that the anatomical neck lies in this space right here. So we've got this ball of the humerus, and directly behind it, it represents the neck, the anatomical neck that's here. And we'll get to the tubercles here in a moment, but you can kind of see on the real bone, there's a bit of a line here too, yes? It's not deep, but you kind of can make out a bit of a line. It's very obvious here. The neck, if we were to look at its anatomical neck, if I was able to remove the ball, right behind it would be the neck. So think about it being right behind the ball of the humerus itself. These two tubercles that I'm talking about are separated by a sulci, which is known as either the intertubecular sulcus or the bicipital groove. Have you guys palpated that? Okay, let's do that. Who wants to be my next victim? This one doesn't hurt, I promise. Come on, somebody. Come on. Here's what you're going to do. It's quite simple. Remember I was talking about putting your hand on the acromion and coming forward. So just by placing your hand on the acromion, you're going to follow the acromion and drop right down and find the head of the humerus right here in the front. Now, what I would like you to do is externally rotate. So think of it this way. So you're going to go this way and this way. Okay, so just give me a second here. So we're going to drop in here. Go ahead. And then back in and out. And back in and out. Okay, so what you're going to do is, if you look at the model here, Sarah, if you look at the model here, you can see the groove in between the two tubercles? See the little groove there? Okay, long head biceps tendon runs right through that groove. And on either side are tubercles. See the right there, right? You can see it. So you have the greater and lesser tubercle here, and the tendon of the long head runs right through that groove. When you're doing this with your patient, what I just did, you'll feel yourself go over one tubercle, drop into the groove, and back out again. And that's what I want you to try. So partner up, hand on the shoulder, drop down to the anterior, drop off the acromion to the anterior humerus. Just have your partner externally and internally rotate while you push fairly firmly, not overly firmly, and see if you can feel yourself drop into the groove and back out again as that bone rolls back and forth. So go ahead. You can go and see him if you want. The way your shirt is not, you're wearing a back brace. I'm like, a back brace for it. Okay, see yourself kind of drop in and come out, drop in and come out. Okay. So the groove between the two tubercles, as I said, is for the tendon of long head biceps. The tubercles on either side of the groove are muscle attachment points, hence the reason why the tubercles are there. So we have a large one, the greater tubercle, which is the lateral tubercle, and we have a smaller one, which lies medial to the sulcus, known as the lesser tubercle. And as I said, we have muscles, especially the rotators of the shoulder, that find attachments on these tubercles, whether they're an internal or a lateral rotator. Okay, so we can see here's our head here, which is the ball. We have the anatomical neck that sits right behind the ball, and then we can see the bicipital groove or the intertubercular groove that we have here with the greater tubercle here out laterally and the lesser tubercle a little bit below and medial to the intertubercular groove here. You're going to get into this a little bit deeper with lab, but you're getting your first sense of you can actually feel yourself drop into that groove. Now, the surgical neck is just distal to the anatomical neck, and this is where the bone narrows to become the body. So we can see the surgical neck kind of lies right here. So we have the anatomical neck here that's right behind the sphere of the ball. The surgical neck is right here. And just the way you get that narrowing in, just distal to that, to the tubercles and the head itself, okay? So the surgical neck is distal to the anatomical neck, the bone narrows to become the body. This is the most frequent site if you get a humerus fracture. This is where you'll tend to fracture, is sort of in the surgical neck area. Superior one half of the body is cylindrical. So if you happen to have one with you, and now you're going to start bringing your bones, aren't you? Unfortunately, I only have one, but you can see that, and I'll pass this around a little bit, but feel proximally, and you can see that it's pretty cylindrical. Cylindrical. If you get distal here, it starts to flatten. So you have more round in the two-thirds, and then it starts to flatten out where it's eventually going to reach its distal components here, right? So we say the superior one half of the body is cylindrical. And there are two features here. The first is called the deltoid tuberosity for the deltoid muscle. So you can kind of see it here just a little bit, right? So the deltoid muscle is your big muscle that caps over your whole shoulder, and proximally it's quite a large muscle. It attaches to a large area, but as it comes distally down the humerus, it comes to a point, right? So it's around the top of the shoulder, comes down to a point, and it's at this point where the deltoid attaches that you find the deltoid tuberosity. Now it's there, but it's not huge. When you palpate this, you have to feel for it, because it's not like a big tuberosity, it sticks right out, that's quite obvious. So if you come down you follow that deltoid muscle down, you get down to that narrow point, and the tuberosity is right in that area where the deltoid comes down. Again, it's a eye closing, got to work at it kind of palpation, because it doesn't really stick out. There is also a groove on here known as the oblique radial groove, and this lies inferolaterally on the posterior aspect of the body. So, of course, the tubercles are anterior. This would be posterior. And this is where the radial nerve and a deep artery lie as they pass the head of triceps. So you can kind of see it here. See the groove? Kind of in here. Now, so if I show it here, here is your radial. There's the deltoid tuberosity. So this is the anterior look here. We're seeing the head of the humerus, anatomical neck, two tubercles, intertubercular groove, and then the surgical neck. We can see here in the anterior view the deltoid tuberosity is out here where deltoids will come down. And when we look at the posterior aspect of the humerus, we can see sort of behind the deltoid tuberosity
is this radial groove. And again, this is where these structures pass around and through.
Distally, we're not so round. On the distal humerus, it starts to widen out. You see it starting to widen. And it forms the medial and lateral supracondylar ridges. The ridges are very obvious. You can see where, again, you have a more cylindrical configuration proximally, and you can see these real sharp edges where it widens out. You can actually feel them. It's very, very, very sharp, or it's widening out into the supracondylar ridges. Remember, the distal part of the epiphysis are called condyles, right? So here's your condyles here. Because these lie superior to the condyles, they're known as the supracondylar ridges. So you can see, again, just how sharp that gets. You can see the edge to it, and that forms, again, just above the condyles are these supracondylar ridges. And you can palpate them, and you're going to do those in lab as well. You can see how it sharpens out on either side. And it's quite sharp. In fact, if you, you just sort of palpate medially in there, you can feel an indentation of soft tissue. So the supracondylar ridges are right above the condyles right here. More round here and comes out to sharp edges. These supracondylar ridges are the attachment for many muscles. In fact, many muscles that attach to these supracondylar ridges actually affect the wrist and hand, not the elbow. Well, to some degree, they'll affect the elbow. But the muscles that affect the hand, actually, some of them arise right around here in their attachments. So we can see here is your both lateral and medial supracondylar ridges. So here's your condyles here. All right. You have your, because they're above, they're the supracondylar. Within that, we also find the condyle of the humerus. Now, does anybody know what a ball peen hammer is? Who said yes? Only one? Anybody else know what a ball peen hammer is? Yeah? What's a ball peen hammer look like? It's round, and it's like so, yes? Okay, so you have a round part and a tubular part. The distal humerus at the condyles looks just like this. Okay? Looks like a ball peen hammer. So you have a spool-shaped trochlea for articulation with the proximal part of the ulna at the trochlear notch. So when we look at the ulna, which we're not going to look at too much at the moment, but we need to consider it. I had them all out yesterday for Clinical Anatomy 1, so I just... here somewhere. I always get worried, that I've left stuff behind sometimes, which would make me very, very angry. Here it is. Okay. This is the ulna. What's it look like? A wrench, right? Okay. So, we have the distal humerus that looks like a ball peen hammer. When we set here a spool-shaped or pulley-like trochlea that articulates with the ulna at the trochlear notch. So the inside of this wrench, this is the trochlear notch. When we put them together, it's a perfect fit, isn't it? A really nice, tight fit. So the round part here is called the trochlea, and it fits in the trochlear notch of the proximal ulna. It's such a tight fit, it can't do anything but flex and extend. Okay, that's all it can do. You can't adduct or abduct. It's locked in because that fit is so tight. All right, so that is known as the trochlea. So this part here, this is the trochlea. All right, so the trochlea articulates with the ulna in the proximal ulna's trochlear notch, a notch to fit the trochlea, okay? Superior to the trochlea, we find two hollows, both anterior and posterior, which lie back to back, which results in a thinning of the bone between the epicondyles. So we had the supracondylar ridges here, and then we have condyles that lie kind of around the condyles. Epi meaning around. So supracondylar ridges are here, and here are the two epicondyles, and the condyles are this. Everybody follow me? Or are you confused? Kind of, sort of. Okay. Supracondylar ridges, epicondyles, and the trochlea, and the round part, which we'll talk about shortly, they represent the condyles. So these two pieces over here, because they surround the condyles, these are the epicondyles. Supracondylar ridges, epicondyles, and then condyles. One of which is the trochlea, which fits in the trochlear notch. Now, when I'm talking about these hollows, the anterior hollow is called the coronoid fossa, which receives the coronoid process of the ulna in elbow flexion. And the posterior hollow is called the olecranon fossa, which accommodates the olecranon of the ulna at full extension. So you can see here, we have these two pieces of the wrench that kind of stick out, right? Okay, this upper one is the olecranon, and this lower one is the coronoid, okay? We'll come back to that, but just can you understand that? Olecranon, coronoid. Okay, so I have a hollow here in the back, right, and here in the front. Okay, here in the back, and here in the front. To allow for full elbow extension, we need this big fossa here to allow the olecranon to fit in. See how it fits in? Which gives us full extension. Without that fossa in there, we couldn't get the full extension. Okay, so we need this hollow to accept the olecranon, which allows for full extension. Everybody follow me? Yes? Makes sense? Okay. The small one in the front is the coronoid fossa, coronoid, which allows the full flexion so that the tip of the coronoid has a place to settle into, which allows for full flexion. It's the same thing, it's just smaller, where the olecranon fossa allows for full extension, the coronoid fossa allows for full flexion. Okay, so see the big hole here, all right, there's your fossa, so which allows for that load in there. There we go, allows for full extension. You can see how the olecranon fits in it. And then the one in the front here, again, right here where my little finger is, allows that coronoid fossa, allows that bit of that coronoid in, which allows for full flexion. Make sense? Yeah? Any questions? Superior to the round part is the shallower radial fossa, which receives the radial head. We'll get into that a bit later. But I'm just going to sort of stay on track, but off a little bit. This is the trochlea. The round part is called the capitulum. The trochlea, which we just looked at in relationship to the ulna, allows for flexion plus extension, which we just saw, yes? Right, everybody agrees with that? So that wrench-like configuration of the proximal ulna and the trochlea allows for flexion and extension only, correct? Yes, everybody agrees with that? Okay, what else, if we do the relationship between the elbow and the hand, we know the elbow and the hand can flex and extend, right? No, the wrist, I'm going to say the hand, I apologize, the wrist. Flex and extend. But what else can occur at this forearm that relates to the wrist and the forearm? It can pronate and supinate. Well, if, where did I put it? There it is. If this is locked in as tight as I showed you and only flexes and extends, then how the hell do we pronate and supinate? It's the radius. Now, the proximal part of the radius is concave. So it looks like this. Okay? So the locked in proximal ulna only does flexion and extension around here. Because this is round, when we pronate and supinate, the radius spins, and so the concavity of the proximal radius spins on the circular capitulum. So flexion and extension of the elbow occurs at the trochlea, and supination pronation occurs at the capitulum. Does that make sense? Kind of, sort of, or no? Any questions? I jumped a little bit ahead because we'll talk about the elbow joint in a couple of weeks, but I just want you to get the sense of it. Can I have Warriors? Can I have Warriors? Because I don't have all of them. Awesome. Thank you. Whoops. Okay. So, this is the ulna, right? The wrench. This is the radius. So, as we said, the trochlea of the proximal ulna fits nicely in the trochlea, which allows for flexion and extension, correct? Everybody's got that? Okay, so that's the trochlea. Well, beside the trochlea is the round capitulum. So now we have a round capitulum with the proximal radius that's concave, so it spins. That allows for flexion and extension, or allows for pronation and supination. Okay, so when we put them together, it's not as easy said as done, is it? We kind of put them together, you can see pronation supination is occurring between the proximal radius and the capitulum, and flexion extension is occurring between the proximal ulna and the trochlea. So trochlea equals flexion and extension, capitulum equals pronation supination. Okay? Yes, they are both the condyles, right? So you have the epicondyles on either side of those, and then you have the supracondylar ridges above those. Okay? Thank you. Any questions? The other part, of course, again, because you have these processes that are part of the proximal ulna in the olecranon and the conoid, then you have to have these fossas, and these fossas are modifications that allow for the full range of flexion and extension that do occur. All right? Now, you get to a point in the olecranon where you lock out, you can't go any further, right? Because that's bone to bone, that's as far as you can go in extension. Because the olecranon is locked right into that olecranon fossa, and it ain't going any farther. If it does, then ligaments and joint stabilizing structures will be disrupted and affected and damaged. Yes? Okay. Does everybody follow that? Okay. Good. So we can see it here. Here's your round capitulum. Here's your tubular trochlea. We can see the olecranon fossa here, which will accept the proximal ulna. It'll fit in here in extension. We can see the coronoid fossa here, which accepts the coronoid process of the proximal ulna in flexion. And we can see that the condyles of the distal humerus are in hyaline cartilage because they're the articulating parts. And we can see that only the capitulum and the trochlea are covered in hyaline cartilage, which is the articulation which will create the elbow joint. Right? So the true elbow joint is only between the ulna and the distal humerus. The radius is not part of the elbow joint because it doesn't really do most of the movement. It allows to move through, but the real elbow joint is actually between the trochlea and the proximal ulna, whereas the radial humeral joint is responsible for pronation and supination. Are you spinning? All right. And no, it's good. Kind of makes sense. Okay. So let's go all the way back up to the glenohumeral joint. It is a multiaxial ball and socket synovial joint. And as we know, we've seen it a few times now this morning, the head of the humerus articulates with the glenoid cavity or fossa of the scapula, right? So the true glenohumeral joint is between the ball of the proximal humerus and the glenoid fossa of the scapula. That's your glenohumeral joint. That's your shoulder joint. It's shallow, as we said. So not only do we have less of a ball in the proximal humerus, We also have an extremely shallow fossa here that accepts the head, and it only covers maybe a third of the head. Again, mobility or stability. Mobility for stability. Okay, this is all about range of motion. So we want this increased range of motion for the shoulder. So we can see the shoulder joint here. There's lots of stuff that goes on the shoulder. There are 1,000-page books written just on the shoulder, okay, because it's such a complicated joint, right? And because it's given up stability, guess what? It gets injured a lot. Baseball pitchers, tennis players, golfers, pickleball players, javelin throwers, doesn't matter. They all have shoulder problems because the shoulder needs to be strong if it's going to function well. So you'll tend to have a lot of people coming to you with shoulder pain. You kind of need to know this area. It takes a bit of work, and you need to assess it and those sorts of things. But there's a lot of stuff that goes on here. And remember that, you know, we look at these ligaments, and they do supply some stability to the joint. But the reality is, this joint really relies on the muscles that cross it to make it stable. It's all about muscle strength. Most of the time, it's about muscle strength. So the first thing is that this glenoid fossa is shallow. So what we need to do is we need to put a labrum around it, which gives it some depth. Not a lot. The labrum that's around the hip joint is much deeper and larger than the labrum that goes around the shoulder joint. But it does provide some depth to the glenoid fossa, the glenoid fossa going around it. So we have a labrum that goes around the glenoid fossa. As I said, above at the superior part of the glenoid fossa is the supraglenoid tubercle. The supraglenoid tubercle is the attachment for long head biceps. Because of where it is, the long head biceps does provide some fibers to the labrum. Now, the interesting thing is, the new books you guys have don't talk about it anymore, and I don't know why, because it's exactly what a slap lesion is. Because I looked it up to see, to give you a page to find it, and I couldn't find it in your books. I thought that was kind of odd. It's not a huge amount of contribution, but it is a bit of contribution. So that intertrabecular groove that you guys palpated has the long head biceps coming up through that bicipital groove between the condyles, comes up through and then attaches on here in the top part of the glenoid fossa at the supraglenoid tubercle. As I say, it provides some fibers to the labrum itself. So far, so good? Okay. Of course, it is a synovial joint, so it has a fibrous capsule. Now, what's interesting is it does enclose the joint, which you would suspect because it is a synovial joint, but there's an extension of the fibrous capsule that travels through the intertrabecular groove. Because the long head biceps tendon that's going to come up through the groove here needs some protection, right? Otherwise, there would be a chance of friction and issues with that tendon. So the fibrous capsule encloses the attachment of the long head biceps within the joint. So we have it, that tendon, as it's coming into the joint, it is surrounded by the fibrous capsule, which helps protect it. Okay? The inferior part of the fibrous capsule is weakest with redundant folds anteroinferiorly. So if we draw the shoulder joint, and I alluded to this when we were doing the axillary, sort of a bit of the axillary palpation. I'm just gonna do this a little bit, and then we're going to do the humerus here. If we do the joint capsule, of course, the capsule will surround the articulating portions of the joint. But then it does this. It has these little tiny folds here inferoanteriorly. And remember I said we need this folding down here to allow for the great range of motion that the shoulder does. If we had a very tight fibrous capsule, again, it would limit how much abduction the shoulder could do. So this these folds here allow for the great range of motion that happens. Say here then, right? So the inferior part is weakest with redundant folds anteroinferiorly. With the arm at the side, the superior part of the capsule is taut, whereas the remainder of the capsule assumes forward and medial twist. So when we're like this, yes, the superior capsule is tight, but everything below is kind of twisted and loose. When we abduct, that all changes, right? The superior capsule will become much more loose, and the inferior parts of the capsule will become very taut, right? Tendons of supraspinatus, infraspinatus, teres minor, and subscapularis blend with the fibers of the joint capsule. So the tendons of these muscles all are intrinsic to the capsule, parts of the capsule. So they, again, remember, muscles stabilize shoulder. So the fact that they have tendons that are also part of the joint of the fibrous capsule gives you a sense of how important it is for those muscles to be strong because of the amount of stability they provide to this highly mobile joint. That's why they play such a strong role. Now, these tendons that run through can also provide apertures in the capsule. But we'll get back to those when we get into the bursa and so forth a bit later. Of course, there's a synovial membrane that lines the fibrous capsule, and which is normal for a synovial joint. And when I said that the fibrous capsule sort of surrounds that long head biceps tendon, of course, within there, we have the synovial membrane as well. So we have a tubular sheath created by underneath the fibrous capsule by the synovial membrane, which allows the biceps tendon to travel through the groove in a nice slippery environment. Make sense? Right? Okay. What's that called? A tube. Do you remember the synovial tube? Look it up. Okay. But fundamentally, it allows that tendon to slide through on movements. So we can see here that we've got our labrum here that surrounds the glenoid fossa, and we can see this is long head biceps right here. And you can see how it provides a little bit of fiber here at the top, okay? And then we can see how long head biceps comes up through the intertrubecular groove, travels over top of the shoulder joint to find its attachment on the supraglenoid tubercle. And of course, this would all be surrounded by fibrous capsule. And then you would have this synovial membrane tube that would run down through here, protecting that long head biceps tendon from scraping at all against here, and allowing it to slip and slide as you do all the movements that occur. And you can see, here's the rotator cuff muscles that we can see here. You can see there's many muscles and tendons that surround this joint, again, providing stability to it. Hence the reason why strong muscles equals good shoulder, okay? You can see at the side here, you can see how that synovial membrane comes down. You can see it here much nicer. Here's the fibrous capsule with the underlying synovial membrane, and you can see how through the groove it creates this environment, this tube, which allows the long head biceps tendon to travel through nicely and not get irritated by the bone as it travels back and forth in any movements, okay? Okay, ligaments. First is the glenohumeral, and this helps check external rotation, and it reinforces the capsule anteriorly, and it is intrinsic. Therefore, it provides fibers to the fibrous capsule. So the glenohumeral, let's see if we can find it here. The glenohumeral is where? Can you see it? Right here. So it's divided into superior, middle, and inferior. But it is all the anterior part here of the joint forming a ligament, providing fibers to the fibrous capsule. Next is the coracohumeral. What's that tell you? Coracoid process to the humerus. It strengthens the capsule superiorly, and it counteracts downward pull or gravity just of the weight of the arm on its own. This ligament does blend with the rotator cuff and fills in the space between subscapularis and supraspinatus. You've all heard the term rotator cuff before. I know you have. What the hell is it? It's a cuff of tendinous tissue formed by the accumulation of muscles that find attachment very close to each other across the shoulder. We will get into this next week, but understand that it's there. So, you know, this coracohumeral here, so we can see here's the coracohumeral here. You can see how it travels over top of the joint. So from the humerus here, outward to over top. And it does, as I say, it does blend with the rotator cuff, because the rotator cuff, the muscles are going to come, some of them are going to come sort of through this space and find attachment here at the greater tubercle. So it does find some attachment at the greater tubercle as it travels over top to the top of the shoulder joint. Next is the transverse humeral. Now, as we said, the biceps tendon travels between the two tubercles, the lesser and the greater tubercle, through the intertubercular groove. We also just found out that the fibrous capsule and the synovial membrane also line the tube so that the tendon is slides in there quite nicely. How does that all get held into place? There is a ligament that runs straight across from the greater to the lesser tubercle in the transverse plane. Hence, it's called the transverse humeral ligament. It goes from the greater to the lesser tubercles of the humerus. It basically is a flat retinaculum for the tendon of long head biceps and its synovial sheath. So you can see it right here is traveling from the greater to the lesser tubercle, overlying the synovial membrane tube that the long head biceps tendon travels through as it heads into the shoulder joint to find its attachment on the supraglenoid tubercle. Had enough yet? Welcome back. You can see it here as well in this diagram. Here we can see the synovial tube coming down for long head biceps, and you can see the transverse humeral ligament holding it in here. Right? This can rupture and cause problems, and in assessments class you're going to learn some tests for it when you get there and that kind of stuff. The next one is the coracoacromial ligament. Coracoid process to the acromion. Again, ligaments always tell you where they are, right? It's covered superiorly by the deltoid muscle. So here is the coracoacromial ligament right here. So running from the coracoid process to the underside of the acromion here. So now this is your homework. How many ligaments have you got here just between the acromioclavicular joint and the glenohumeral joint? There's lots, right? And you need to know them. So that's kind of your challenge. Maybe I'll put this diagram on your quiz for next week. I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm kidding. But this is how complicated this shoulder joint is and the amount of work you need to do to get to know it. Because we haven't even gotten into the bursa yet that are in here. Because we have bursa because of all this stuff that crosses that all needs to be protected. The next is called the coracoacromial arch. We're still in the ligaments here. It is formed by the coracoid process, the coracoacromial ligament, and the acromion. Now, it does assist in preventing dislocation of the humeral head superiorly. So that humeral head can't come up well and dislocate that way. But this is a bit of a, wasn't a great thing when it was created. It's a bit of a problem. So you can see that the coracoacromial arch, right? The coracoacromial arch is this area right here. So as we said, it is the coracoid process, the coracoacromial ligament, and the acromion. So there's the coracoid process, the coracoacromial ligament, and the acromion here. What it does, it forms an arch. Actually, I think it was the next diagram. Oh, wrong one. Right here. It forms an arch here. Can you see? Here's the coracoid process. Here's the coracoacromial ligament, and here's the acromion. Can you see this space right here? Yes? Okay. So when I create the bones here without the soft tissue, you can see the space to some degree there, yes? Okay. Looks nice and spacious, doesn't it? It's not. There's nothing in here, right? We only have bone. We don't have any soft tissue in here yet. We don't have the labrum and all the ligaments that we're just talking about here, right? This coracoacromial ligament and so forth. Well, what can happen is, because this space is so tight, if there is inflammation of a tendonitis, then you can see in abduction, what just happened to the space? Got smaller, didn't it? Right?
And there's tendons and things that travel through there. And when they're swollen and sore, the patient will demonstrate pain as they try to get in here, because all the structures that lie underneath this arch of the coracoid process, coracoacromial ligament, and the acromion, they get pinched and the patient can't move through the full range of motion. So it's impinged, and that's as far as they can get because they can't go any further because it hurts. Right? This is classic. It's called shoulder impingement. It's usually supraspinatus tendonitis or supraspinatus damage of some kind or other, which is a muscle that's in one of the rotators. It's not a rotator, but it's considered part of the rotator cuff. So the patient will get to this far, and that's as far as they'll get. The real classic is they'll do this, and then they'll take their hand over above, and then they're fine again. So from here to here, they can't function because that's the full impingement. It's really jamming that tendon home. So they literally will go to here, bring their shoulder up, and then finish. Right? So that's your classic impingement. So that represents the coracoacromial arch. The last one is the influence of the joint capsule, which I've talked about. Of course, the twisting increases as the arm swings into abduction. Tension increases in the capsule, so you end up getting the capsule that pulls the humerus around into external rotation. So as you get here, the humerus actually starts to externally rotate, just naturally, because the capsule will actually pull in that direction. External rotation allows the capsule to untwist, allowing further range of motion. So we get to here, it's untwisting, which pulls the humerus a bit into external rotation, which even gives us more range of motion via the fibrous capsule. If there's no external rotation, the greater tubercle impinges on the coracoacromial arch. So that greater tubercle will get, if we don't externally rotate, get stuck under the acromion. As soon as we externally rotate, it gets out of the way and we can finish. See ya. I know you're all going to be like, we're back. Seriously, we're done. I'm not kidding. So obviously, like normal, next week's class will start with a quiz out of 10 that's related to everything we talked about today. I am